Hey, beautiful people. Do you know what happened at 9:18 a.m. last Monday that I'm still trying to wrap my head around and I'm still reeling from? So 18 minutes, that's how long it took for something that I've been working on for months, if not, well, yeah, genuinely years, to completely sell out. Well, almost and partially. So last Monday, we opened registration for our first ever Healthy Friends Wellness Retreat deep in the green leafy wilderness, 90 minutes from Melbourne CBD here in Australia. And VIP tickets, they were gone in 18 minutes. Not only were the VIP tickets gone, but 10 of our 12 spots were filled. And I guess the remaining people on the wait list, pretty much all of those people were wrestling with other holiday plans that they already had in place and the ability or inability to get work off. And so that means that I'm here now with you to share that we've still got a couple left, right? And we've got retreat guests flying in from the UK. Like, wow, people are coming from overseas to be a part of this. Like, and imagine that commitment to your own health, right? We've got interstate people coming from around Australia to be here. I know half of these people as former clients and half of these people as people that I'll meet for the first time. And from what I know, this group is going to be electric and I can't wait to get everybody in the room together. I'm telling you this because we have exactly 2 premium guest spots left. And this isn't a gimmick. We actually have 2 premium guest spots left. A fellow podcaster asked me, like, do you really have 2 or is that just like a marketing thing? It's like, no, we actually have 2. And so what's involved, right? So we've got 4 days of morning yoga, transformative workshops on health. We've got screen detox. We've got some body detox. We've got some guided nature walks and the fireside conversations that change everything, these deep D&Ms. The real magic, though, is the tribe that you'll become a part of, which I think is the real power of these types of in-person immersive events. They create lifelong connections and friendships with people that hold quite similar values to you. And that, I believe, is the invaluable part, the most important piece, because it goes far beyond just the retreat. Plus, we also have a private chef for the entire time as well. So that's pretty fancy. If you've been listening to this show for some time and thinking, I wish I could work with Matty or meet him in person or hang out with him and his team, I guess literally this is the first and only opportunity since I began almost 7 years ago to do that. And if you want to have a bit more of a visual on what to expect, you can go to my Instagram account, The Real Weight Loss Coach, and simply look at a highlight, the highlight called Retreat, and you'll see how swish the accommodation is that we're staying in. It's like fancy hippie. And so we've got 2 spots remaining. Payment plans are available if that feels easier as well. The link to grab your ticket is in the show notes down below. So scroll down, click the link and get your ticket, because if you're hearing this on the podcast, somewhere between 15 and 25,000 people are also hearing it. So if you want one, literally, be quick. That's not hype. That's genuine reality of numbers. So be quick, grab your ticket, and I'll see you later this year at the Healthy Friends Wellness Retreat. This is episode 464, Cancer. As someone that worked in the field of cancer not that long ago, I genuinely can't believe how high the cancer diagnosis numbers are getting. And in the last few years alone, literally the last 5 years, it's taken a big jump forward, particularly in the USA. But the rest of the world is not far behind. If you have a diagnosis, have cancer in your family, or you think your body isn't really in the best state of health or strength, and it's possible that at some point in the future you're heading towards disease, then I recommend that you listen to this episode, because I speak with the author of the award-winning book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, about the question no one asks. Why? Why are so many people getting cancer? And why are the numbers going up at such an alarming rate? Why do I ask the question why? Because when we know the why, then we can ask with much more direction and clarity how. And in this conversation, we talk about the how in a way that will probably shock you. For speaking to a medical professional, this chat took many unexpected turns and became a really juicy conversation that might help you in ways that you really don't expect. So, without further ado, let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome to today's conversation. And before we drop into the good stuff, let's get the formalities out of the way. First up this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on the scale. So if you want to work on any of your emotional binge or overeating patterns that have contributed to your weight gain or your metabolic health challenges, and you want to stop gaining weight and start healing, then scroll to the show notes, to the caption or to the show notes to click the button, click the link, book a call, and let's have a conversation to see if we are a good fit to work together or not. Okay, one of my favorite humans to have on this podcast is here again. She's been on episode 95, episode 223, and now this one. We have the famous integrative oncology specialist, cancer expert, Dr. Naysha Winters. Once a cancer patient herself, this incredible woman is transforming the world of cancer treatment. She's building an alternative cancer treatment hospital. She's got a supplement company. She runs a non-for-profit metabolic research lab specifically for your integrative cancer lab results. And she has multiple courses and content to educate practitioners, doctors, coaches, and anybody really that wants to listen and learn about how to manage or reduce their cancer burden in a very different way to that which you might have heard from a doctor or from the media. And as I discovered just before we hit record, there's actually a list that could go probably the next hour of her amazing credibility, accolades, achievements. So let's just get into the conversation. Naysha, how you doing?
Oh my gosh, it's so good. We were just marveling at the fact that we're literally a day apart, but we're both experiencing rain today. So we get to experience this together in faraway parts of the world. I marvel at that. The awesomeness of that is just a beautiful way to start our day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so nice to just be connected again. Your energy is contagious in the best possible way. I love it.
Oh, thank you. And what a great intro. I really appreciate it. And as I was telling you before we started, it might seem like I'm doing a lot of things, but you actually made a human. And so I'm just high-fiving you for that. That is so amazing to me. Very cool.
Oh, it's so cool. And it's interesting too, because there's never been a time where I've focused on health more, which is like in bringing a human into the world. Because as I'm sure you're aware, there's all of these conversations around vaccines and like all of these ways of doing things and the way that pregnancy and childbirth happens. And so Yali and I have been so deep in research in a way that I've never been in it before. It's more been my education to understand the world, whereas now it's like education to make sure this human grows healthy and strong and amazing and is safe.
Love it. Can you imagine had we had the same opportunities that you're bringing in to your child? To think, have such a thoughtfulness and an intention around everything you're putting in on and around that little person and in your household and in your community and in your country that will make or break this person's longevity and healthjevity. So very interesting times that we live in that we just can't just show up and just go about our business as per usual today. We actually have to work a little bit harder at it to have a better life and a better outcome than our great grandparents might have had to do.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, it's funny too, because understanding all that we do about personal development and trauma and the way that our parents impacted us and all that kind of stuff, I'm constantly joking with Yali. I'm like, how do we make sure this kid doesn't want to rebel against this and hate natural health?
You probably just plop that into the universe of like, this kid will want to eat Twinkies and they have to differentiate. They've always got to push their own boundaries to find their way back, but they often will. You're planting the seeds now that whether they stray from it now, they will often return to it later. So you do the best you can with the resources you have.
I'm going with that. But you mentioned like our great grandparents and people that were around a long time before we were. And that sort of sets a good frame for where I wanted to start our conversation today. Because when it comes to cancer and oncology treatment and that whole breadth of diseases, we're in a time where it seems like everyone knows somebody that's got cancer. I was looking at the data for both the USA and Australia before we jumped on. And it's just like, the numbers are going up at staggering rates of the amount of people that are diagnosed. But historically, I'm curious, when did cancer rates start to proliferate? When did they start going exponentially through the roof? And what happened at that point in history?
So, I mean, cancer's not new. I mean, we find it in some of our oldest samples out there from mummifications from thousands of years ago. It's not like this is a new phenomenon, but it's definitely more common today, which still doesn't make it normal, but it does make it more common. And so we've seen a few blips in time where we saw rates come up a little bit. So our first blip And I can't remember the exact numbers, but we started noticing a few more registering in the Neolithic farming era about 10, 11,000 years ago. And we just started moving and changing the way we farmed and the way we hunted and the way we set up roots. And so in that, we started exposing ourselves to different environments that we'd never been exposed to before. And one of the genes that came forth at that time that didn't exist prior to the Neolithic farming era that lends itself to being more vulnerable to cancer and other chronic illnesses is something known as the human leukocyte antigen, the HLA gene. So some people have heard about this gene when they hear about celiac disease. So celiac disease is the genetics is an HLA-DQ gene. Okay. And so, but there's multiple, there's dozens of HLA, human leukocyte antigen genes, and we can express many, many of those or a few of those or none of those depending on your own genetic familial origins. But that was a moment that we brought a new gene into the world that made us more sensitive and vulnerable to the environment around us, specifically making us a higher incidence of things like autoimmunity. So reactivity to things we were being exposed to, mold exposure, to viral exposures, and just immune function in general started to behave a little bit differently at that time. So we saw a blip on the screen then. Fast forward, the next big change that happened was in the early 1800s to 1850s with the introduction of the Industrial Food Revolution. So we had kind of a nice 10,000 year run where it was pretty stable, Mabel. But then we had another blip come up when we started to process food, right? Mm-hmm. We started to make our food in factories versus on farms or in hunting in those places. So we started to do a lot more input and chemicalization and processing of our food items, which started to wreak some havoc on our microbiome, on our immune systems, on inflammatory processes, which are some of the key drivers to turning on or off certain switches in our physiology, our biochemistry, and even our genetic expression is from some new things that we were exposed to that made us even vulnerable again. So again, I think if memory serves, and I could be getting this wrong, but it's somewhere in the ballpark of around 1 in 300 people were having cancer at that started happening at that time. And that was a pretty big jump. So I think it was like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 500. It was still happening, but this was a bit more significant. That kind of held its own for a long time. But the next big change happened after World War II. And so after World War II is when we started to take all that excess ammo and we started to dump it into big ag and big pharma. New input again into a system that had never seen these things before. Right? We actually brought in input into big pharma and big ag that were made from wartime warfare, like biological warfare that became our pharmaceuticals, as well as our food programs, our food systems. So when you think about that, was another big kablam to the system. Fast forward a few years later in the late 1960s, we started to experiment with and utilize because we wanted to feed the world. We started to bring on glyphosate to be this massive antibiotic to herbicides, fungicides, to all the weeds that were threatening our crops. But we also wanted to ripen food at the same time so that we could get it into production more efficiently and effectively. And then we had another big shift about 5 years ago, which was this shift of a new virus, no matter what your belief systems are or the reality may be, we may never know, of where that virus came from, it changed something in our physiology, in our biochemistry. And so when I started in medical school, I started seeing things back in the 90s that the average age of a patient with cancer was 68. At that time, I believe it was 1 in 1,100. It was about 1 in 300, 100, 1 in 250 was still kind of our disease rate of cancer, but it was getting more and more, still up there. But that started to change kind of exponentially in the last 30, 40 years. And really, as of, you mentioned stats today, which is just the 2025 stats just rolled out about 2 weeks ago. So both the World Health Organization, the IARC, which is like a third party international association of research in cancer group, that's a third party research organization, as well as the American Cancer Society and other global networks in oncology. We now have 1,700 people per day in the United States dying of cancer.
Whoa, that's enormous.
1,700. The last time this was done, I think the last time we looked at this statistic, that was less than 3 years ago, that was 1,600 a day. That was still phenomenally high numbers, but that's a big jump in a short period of time. That's daily in the US alone. Globally, 26,500 people a day are dying of cancer.
Wow. So there's a massive proportion of that number is in the USA.
Massive number. We've got one of the highest rates in the world.
Wow.
I know.
Go on.
Well, just a few other little statistic bombs to drop into the mix here. In the last couple of years, cancer has now overtaken cardiovascular disease as the number one cause of death in 12 developed countries, of which the United States is one of them. So that's a first time in human history that that's ever happened. And now our statistics, up until I can still remember when I was in med school, it was like one in eight people will be exposed. I can still remember it coming down, like one in 250, one in 150, one in 100, one in 50, one in 10. Like, I was watching those numbers over my career. I believe when I started in private practice, it was like one in 12 would have cancer in their lifetime. It's now one in two.
Oh my God.
One in two. Flip a coin, folks.
And that's in such a small period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the weird thing to me, Maddie, is no one's asking why. Well,
I was just about to ask why.
Yeah. Well, my hope is that even just a little bit of the story, the context I shared, starts to get wheels turning, but we can unpack that further. But I thought I just wanted to start out by landing that into the room because it can feel daunting and overwhelming and a bit, I don't know, kind of futile, but I really want people to know that there's hope.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned the futility because if you're, I guess, either you or I or anyone that's interested in health or maybe a cancer patient that's simply on Instagram, basically everything you've ever looked at, seen, breathed, eaten causes cancer. And it can be really overwhelming and intense because, and I've had these moments in my educational journey where I sort of had to restructure the way I think about the world because I would like going from conventional cancer treatment in a hospital and working in that system. And then as I sort of educated myself, I had these really depressive periods where I was like, everything's bad, like big pharma's working against me, the government wants me dead. Like, and I'm obviously exaggerating to some extent, but it's easy to get to those dark places of thinking, especially if you go down rabbit holes of big pharma and their interest in medication and keeping people alive long enough to sell the drugs and profit-driven healthcare systems and blah, 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 all of those kind of things. It can get really dark and like, what's the point? I might as well eat the cake and race go-karts and breathe in the toxic fumes. I race go-karts, by the way. But it's something as because of what I do, like when I'm there, I literally said to Yali with Gabriel, while she was pregnant, don't come to the go-kart track. Mm. Like, don't be breathing in those toxins, right? And so I walk around with this knowledge like you do too, and or this burden of awareness. And so for anyone that's on that journey, it's like, it's everything. But when we're coming back to that initial question of why this is happening, what are the big whys that actually move the needle or that are a real leverage point to be able to make a significant difference? Because I'm sure there's about 1,000 things that we could try that move the needle 0.1%.
Yeah. Great. Well, first of all, I love that question. And my hope is like giving that context is a really good starting point of the why. So what we had thought for the past since 1914, we have qualified cancer as a genetic mutation, as just bad luck and just a genetic mutation, and we'll go after it with a genetic solution. Well, that hasn't panned out. Okay, like to put it mildly. In fact, let me just help, and I'm sure I've said this on other podcasts, but I just want to remind folks that if this was truly a genetic situation, within each of our cells, we have these little organs known as organelles. Mm-hmm. And the biggest organ within those cells is known as the nuclei, which is like where the genetic material is housed, which is inside your cells. If this was truly a genetic disease, we could remove the nuclei of a healthy cell and replace the nuclei of a cancer cell and turn that cancer cell into a healthy cell. Or we could remove the nuclei of a cancer cell and replace the nuclei of a healthy cell and turn that cell into a cancer cell. Pretty cut and dry. That would be the genetic origin, cause, and cure for cancer. Mm-hmm. Well, that experiment has been done. It's called the nuclear cell transfer study many times over, all over the world for many decades. And it still has the same result, which means it does not happen at the nuclei level. It is not happening at the genetic level. In fact, even standard of care today says that cancer is 90 to 95% of the time directly related to our dietary or lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
That's standard of care saying that. And yet that potential of 5% having a potentially true genetic origin, we put all of our eggs in the basket of the research and the treatment for that 5%.
Yeah.
That's where we've been resources for over 100 years.
Learning that information when I was working in the cancer hospital, even though I was just a minion down the bottom, and I literally went to my professor at the time and I said, if 90 to 95% of this is diet and lifestyle, as per the Australian Cancer Council website, why is this hospital not full of dietitians and nutritionists and exercise physiologists? And I was maybe 22 years old at this point, and he just laughed at me. And someone I still greatly respect, he just laughed and said, oh, Maddie, if it was that simple, we would have figured it out ages ago. And I was like, I'm still confused.
Right. Yeah, because maybe he's right. Maybe we haven't figured it out, but we're certainly not looking in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's that old adage. I share this story all the time about a cop coming across a guy on a dark night, and the guy's underneath the streetlight and he's looking around. The cop's like, what are you doing? What are you doing here? And the guy's like, oh, I lost my keys. I'm looking for him. So the cop's helping him out. And they're looking for his keys. After a while, he's like, geez, clearly I'm not seeing him here. Do you remember at all where they were? And he points behind him into a dark bush. And he's like, oh, I dropped him over there. And the cop's like, wait, what? Why are you over here then? He goes, well, this is where the light is. You guys, yeah. We are looking under the streetlight when it's all in the dark bushes.
Yeah, completely. Well, you know. And I would even argue that the bushes aren't that dark. Diet and lifestyle modifications aren't insanely complex.
But human behavior is complex. And that's the trick, right? And that's the trick of understanding. So coming back, understanding our own response and reactivity to situations and things that we're being exposed to on a regular basis also dictates the way we show up for ourselves and for other people in the world. And so that takes a lot more time, resources, and finesse to figure out and to address. And it's not a quick write of a script or a quick 7-minute office visit. It's a lot. It requires a lot more human support, right? So now we've got a little context. So let's talk about a deeper why. So now I kind of showed you these major times in human evolution where we had big changes and our bodies adapted or didn't, depending on the situation. So how we understand here is one of these little organelles, I mentioned the nuclei within the cell. There's another little organelle within the cell known as the mitochondria. Now, all of us probably learned that in biology in sixth grade, that it's the ATP, the energy factory of our cells. It's that, but it's so much more. And we've really only started to just begin to scratch the surface on what it really is and what else these little mighty mitochondria can do, as well as how they relate within what's called the cytoplasm or the goo swimming pool within those cells, the interface there, the communications there, the other organelles that were seemingly junk organs. We're starting to go, wait, there's a lot more going on here. But simply put, let's look at the mitochondria for a moment. And this might start to answer, at least get us closer to looking into the bushes than under the bright light under the street, right? So mitochondria, three major jobs, very simple. Major job is they take in information. They are receivers. So they are scanning the world around them. Okay, taking in all the information, food, water, light, air, sound, stress, from physical stress, chemical stress, functional stress, anatomical stress, emotional stress, traumatic stress, all of that is information in that the mitochondria interfaces with. Let me start a little bit before that. Mitochondria evolved from, they're bacteria. That's what they are. We can trace them back for upwards of, depending on the research, 170 to 200,000 years ago. And they somehow merged with our little crazy ecosystem somewhere along the road at that time. And we now know that our mitochondria make up between 10 and 20% of our body composition, which is so fascinating to me. These tiny little organelles are actually, they take up a lot of real estate in us. So you're thinking about that 20%, upwards of 20% of you is constantly scanning the environment with new information. And when I told the story about, think about 10,000 years ago, new information, 1800s, new information, World War II, new information, the last 5 years, new information. Our bodies now, the information is coming in so fast and furious, it does not even know what to do with it. So the first job of the mitochondria, take that information in. Second job, make sense of that information. So it's the translator. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, depending on that kind of information and depending on your personal individual blueprint, your own experience in the world, you might translate that information like the operator game. Remember playing that as a kid? It's like, no, I said frog, not fog. It's like, we might be giving it different information and it's scrambling that data. And the third job is communication and signaling. So it's like, I've collected the information, I've made sense of it, and now I'm telling the body, the cells, the cytoplasm, the other mitochondria, the nuclei, the other tissues, organs, structure, skeletal mass, the energy around the field of the person, what to do with this information. Mm-hmm. Signaling pathways, right? So what we have since learned in the last 2000 is when we first started talking about this, was these concepts of the hallmarks of cancer. Mm-hmm. And we've put a lot of energy, a lot of resources into studying these major hallmarks, which are basically the expression, the signaling of what happens when cancer expresses. So, Hey, grow, baby, grow. That's one of the hallmarks. Another hallmark is we don't know when to stop. That's another hallmark. Another one is we hide from the immune system. Another hallmark is we love glucose. We prefer that. Another one is we hide out in these senescent cells and we kind of hang out until we bide our time until we can get big again. But ultimately, we've moved from 6, then a few years later to 10, and then a few years later to 14. And now we're somewhere between 14 and 19 hallmarks or contributing hallmarks of cancer. And to make it simple, those are just signaling pathways. But no one's even asking, and why we haven't made great strides in 25 years, being able to define the hallmarks still hasn't changed our outcomes. In fact, it's getting worse. It's because no one's saying, well, what made those signals behave that way? No one's saying, how is it translated and what was the input? So that is the work that I do. I'm the person who wants to understand what information is coming in. How is it being translated in this N of one experience being? And how are the signaling pathways being sent out? Like how is it communicating out in the world? And then how can I improve upon the signaling or the communication, improve upon the translation, and improve upon the input in? Right? And so that is a big difference. Those are all, they take an enormous amount of patience and inquiry and exploration and understanding. But we've so normalized the world around us that we don't question what we're putting in, on, or around us. And if we do, we get called things like tinfoil hat wearing freako. We get called conspiracy, right? Literally, we get called conspiracy theorists. We get called orthorexics. No, yes. We get called hypochondriacs. We get called a lot of things when we simply ask questions. And when we simply start to explore, like, wait a minute, remember that, gosh, before World War II, we now have over 80,000 new chemicals on the market that have not been properly tested. We have entirely different farming practices and food processing practices. We have more sugar than ever today, from 5 pounds per person per year to, depending on the studies, 145 to 175 pounds of sugar per person per year. Since the 1850s, we have more chemical inputs. We have now normalized or given diseases. We now call things like menopause a disease and therefore have a medication for it. Or we call mental health, like we're not asking the right questions around why are people dealing with mental health. We're not asking questions in the United States as to why our longevity is worse than anybody in the world. We're losing it every year while everyone else is either stable or improving. No one's asking why. The scientists are calling it the era of despair, but no one's saying, why do we have higher rates of suicide, higher rates of gun violence, higher rates of opiate overdose, higher rates of these things that are taking our lives in a shorter period of time? We had higher rates of death during COVID. We're ranked, I think, number 54 now worldwide in health That's a big jump from the 36th where we were. We spend the most on healthcare in the world and are the sickest in the world. Like, no one's asking why. Well, so that's what we're doing. We're asking why.
Yeah, which I think is fantastic. And that's the reason that I no longer work in a cancer hospital, because asking why was not a popular question nor encouraged. And even when I did get to know some of the dietitians in that environment that I thought, oh, maybe they're trying to fight the good fight from the inside, even it felt like they were just as indoctrinated as the doctors. And apart from increasing protein intake so that our microalbumin numbers looked a little bit better, that there wasn't much. It was just an encouragement of, we need calories into somebody that's going through chemotherapy, and calories looks like McDonald's, KFC, ice cream, pizza.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way that I always interpreted that in my naive, young, early 20s, I was like, I understand the liver to interpret things in two ways, nutrient, toxin. And so if chemo is processed as a toxin and the stuff in McDonald's food is also processed as a toxin, aren't we just adding to a toxic bucket? And that was too simple. And at the time, I believed that was too simple, in the sense that I was like, oh yeah, I'm like 24 and I don't really know, and everybody else here is basically a genius and I'm just some guy at the bottom of the hierarchy. But still, 10, 15 years later, I still stand by that idea.
Well, it's really funny. You talk about the simplicity. Somehow we think if something's simple, it's not enough. Like, complex and complicated are two different things.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think it plays into our intelligence bias, because like, people that are into health, and like, whether you're the doctor or whether you're the patient, and I talk to my own clients about this, is that smart people want a complex answer because simple, like, that's offensive to their IQ. Yes.
It's funny. My husband, who is honestly one of those smart people, he's a crazy biochemist. He was cancer drug design in grad school. He studies and teaches epigenetics at the bench side as well as the bedside to clinicians and researchers around the globe. I mean, he literally like lives in this realm, but he's told me stories, and I'm going to completely slaughter it, but he gives examples of, you know, when we were racing to get to the moon and racing to get satellites and stuff out there, we were in the US, we were in competition with Russia. Right. And we were in this massive race, and we were trying to come up with these complicated solutions to basically getting ourselves to space faster than our Russian colleagues. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing is at the end of the day, millions, what would have probably been billions in today's dollars later, the Russians still beat us in that race, and their solution was a pencil. So he gives, and I know I'm slaughtering, maybe I'll find it and get you, we can put this in those show notes, but there was this really cool solution that was so simple, it was overlooked.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what you're speaking to, is like, if somehow it's not super complicated, we can't accept it. And so that's just super fascinating to me. And the crazy thing is, the patients that I serve and the colleagues that I train and the researchers that I work with, we so often overlook the fundamentals that you cannot build a sturdy structure on a weak foundation. And these fundamentals are overlooked. These foundational principles are virtually ignored, from the patients all the way up to the powers that be writing the research and funding the research in the medical field. And we're forgetting the fundamentals.
Well, something you said earlier, which I think is interesting in regards to the human behavior element of all of this, because I think as a species, we've come an extremely long way in using our brains to solve logical problems and mathematical problems and things that we can get thing A and thing B, and that equals thing C, and that makes sense. But interestingly, as you're obviously aware, but we haven't done the same thing with the other half of the brain, or the other part of the brain, which is our emotional brain. And it leads me to think that the fundamentals are often overlooked, because doctors or any kind of health professional doesn't believe the person or the patient in front of them has the capacity to change their diet successfully, or doesn't believe they have the capacity to actually change the fundamentals, which are ingrained in what we do every single day. And so we just kind of think, human behavior, we're all weak, we're all pathetic, we all love chocolate. And so this person's not going to do that, so I'm not even going to talk to them about it. And even if I do, I'll just do it in a judgmental way. Like, yeah, sure, eat healthy, do whatever you like. But chemotherapy, though, and it's that outsourcing of responsibility because the taking on of responsibility is something we emotionally have to navigate.
Wow. Boy, there's so many pieces there that we could unpack and just spend the entire session here. I mean, first of all, the outsourcing our responsibility, massive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a time when we did not run to the doctor for every little bump and scrape that ailed us or every little sniffle, right? We didn't even have access to doctors. And when we did, they would usually come to our home. So these doctors that would come to our home, they would walk into your home and they would see how you lived. You could not tell them, no, I only have one drink at night when it might be one drink at night, or no, I don't live in filth or there's like cat excrement all around them or something. Like those, some of my favorite times as a practitioner was doing house calls because people cannot hide from me in those situations. And we've lost that art of medicine, which is what we did for millennia. You know, like we got to know the person, their environment very intimately, their relationships very intimately. You couldn't hide what was going on and you lived in a daily interaction with these folks. So there was a bit more responsibility and accountability that was there, that now there's like a distance. And then things like telemed create an even bigger distance. You can even make yourself look and feel anyway in these situations that we have today. So I think that's really interesting. The other piece that I thought was very interesting you brought up, which is so true. And so in my trainings for clinicians, I say this all the time. Your belief systems impact your patient's outcomes. Period. There's like,
I like that.
Plenty of evidence of this. So if a doctor is afraid that this patient's going to die, that is being poured into the room and that patient's field will respond to that. As esoteric and woo-woo as that sounds, we actually have good, meaningful studies and data around that. But I also tell my doctors that your belief system that they can do something different or do something better also impedes their ability to do this. So if you expect them to just be lazy or to not eat well or whatnot, they won't. But if you, because people will always say to me, why are your patients so compliant with their diet and their lifestyle interventions? I'm like, because I expect them to be. I know they can be. And the other part of it is I walk my walk. I walk my talk. And I tell my colleagues that if you're not, your patients will know. And in the times that I'm not walking my walk or my talk very much, like coming off the week I came off with last week, I am in my recovery mode. I'm licking my wounds of pushing myself very, very far last week because it's things I love that I'm doing, but they still cause my physiology harm. I take ownership with it. I'm transparent about it. I show folks that I too am human and I have my own struggles, but I still pull up my big girl panties and keep moving forward and keep getting back on the wagon if I fall off. And so I have the expectations that none of us are going to be perfect with it, but we all do the best we can with the information we have. And then I think the third thing is this concept of cognitive dissonance. You kind of wove it in a little bit here and we sort of woven into the conversation thus far. But there's this moment when someone looks at something, new information that challenges what they used to know. Mm-hmm. You have a choice. It is a crossroad. You can say, okay, I forgive myself that I didn't know this. I didn't know what I didn't know until I now know. But now with this new information, this new data input, what I choose to do with it, I now am responsible for. There are so many people living in cognitive dissonance that they can see the writing on the wall of what is wrong or what is right with any given situation. But for them to face that, own that, and move away from that will challenge everything they've ever known. And a lot of people are not wired to do that, which is unfortunate because it's called having grace for yourself and others. It's like, I think about so many times in my practice, the way I used to, like the way I practiced 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's different. I've learned new information. I apply it differently, right? We all need to do that together, but we kind of dig in our heels and make it out like, this is the only way. And even when we're on a sinking Titanic, we're like, it still is like bubbling. I'm still the only way to do it. As we're going down. Like that is our weird human nature.
Yeah.
So very interesting points that you brought up because the why are we still going down, like looking for the keys and under the light on the street? Why are we still doing research in the genetic origins of cancer and genetic treatments of cancer? We've known for a very long time that is not where the answers lie.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there.
Yeah, I'm curious as a culture or as a species where this has come from. And I've got all sorts of political rabbit holes going on in my mind, all the way back to like the Colosseum being built to distract people from what's really going on, like so that the Roman Empire wasn't challenged by its own people. And if we fast forward that to today, now we have YouTube and Netflix. And so the point is that like there's all of these ways to distract yourself from your own experience. And almost every minute of our waking hours can be not being present or aware. So I'm wondering if once upon a time we were more tuned in and unafraid of new information. And it's been the ongoing snowball effect of capitalism and business. Because even in every business training I've ever done, it's like you've got to solve problems for people so they don't have to think about them, right? That's the whole idea of business, is that you solve a problem for someone so they don't have to burden it. And so I'm really extrapolating my thinking here, obviously, but this idea that as a culture, we now are just afraid of having to think or solve problems or confront them for ourselves to the point that we just escape into some dopamine-filled pleasure, doom scroll, porn, Netflix, whatever it is.
Wow. I mean, I think distraction is really huge. I think that when you have, there's been also lots of times in history where we've had distraction of wars, we've had distraction of religions, we've had distraction of medical breakthroughs. I mean, you were a charlatan if you, there was a time, I think about like even the witch hunts and things that instead of someone going, oh, these were just the women, we were moving from the matriarchy into the patriarchy and we were basically killing off our healers. Our original healers were women and midwives and herbalists, and they got basically exterminated to make room for these more patriarchal ideas. And so that's just one example. Or even in the time of the Salem witch hunts, which is always a fascinating era for me, what people weren't understanding is that they were like, well, what about these sort of hallucinations of these people and all these things? Well, we learned later that there was this huge outbreak of a particular fungus that was afflicting the minds of these folks that were perceiving them as being lunatics, of being crazy. And yet we then called them witches and drowned them instead of saying, why are they having these experiences? Like we are so quick to silence or suppress something or roll over it and make it truth that we create these polarities constantly. And we're living in the kind of a global polarity constantly, but even more so I feel in the last few years. I mean, we've all watched these things come and go in our lifetimes, but it just seems like it's in our face more. Mm-hmm. Which is very, very interesting. We all have a cause. We all have something that bothers us. But think about this, you guys. I mean, you, I don't know, Maddie, how young you are, but I was from the era of a rotary phone, right? Where my phone was plugged into a wall and I got an hour at night. My mom would give me an hour at night to talk to friends. And she's always thought that was even too much. Like, what in the world do you have to say to an hour to a bunch of junior high or high school friends? It was our time frame. We then would get together in person to go out. We like all these different ways of connecting. We had some separation. We didn't have, like, I didn't have cable we were poor growing up. So we had the rabbit ears on our TV. So we had exactly like, I could watch the Dukes of Hazzard. I could watch the Love Boat. Those were my access to the outside world. Right. But then what happens is it's now in our face all the time. So we get to see the travesties in like Rwanda and what's happening constantly in Ukraine or in Miramar or in LA or in like, we can't get away from the trauma, the war, the dramas, the transgressions of the world. Our nervous systems were never wired to experience that much input. So we talked back to the mitochondria being a receiver.
Yeah.
We were never meant to live in perpetual fear, okay, which is where we pretty much live today. The level of anxiety, especially in our youth, they are like the representation of the mitochondria on our planet as well, taking in so much they can't filter anything and translate anything. The world is inherently unsafe for so many people today that the only way you can truly overcome that is to completely unplug from it. You have to make a concerted effort and create some extreme willpower and self-accountability and responsibility to put this stuff down.
Mm.
You have to. It's everywhere. And you mentioned the other big trigger. So you have the fear that keeps you hypervigilant. Then you have the dopamine that keeps you addicted. So each time, ding, 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 like, we're addicted. So we have a very different wiring today in our nervous systems than any time in humanity, even more so. Some of the neuroscientists and researchers out there have shown that our nervous systems today are way more traumatized than those of like World War I, World War II, civil wars. Because even in those environments, they could put it down for a moment. Or their loved ones back home had no idea what was going on the battlefields. We are all on the battlefields all the time today. All the time.
Yeah.
And you really cannot put it down unless you take a concerted effort to do just that. And so thinking about those mitochondria that are just constantly taking in that information. I mean, the studies through psychoneuroimmunology, psychoneuroimmunoendocrinology, those inputs change the wiring of our brain, the wiring of our nervous system, the wiring of our immune system, the wiring of our neurotransmitters, the wiring of our hormones and endocrine communication systems. So when we're constantly being hit by that, it's like the translation, as I mentioned before, all that input coming in, but then we're translating it. Because hormones are translators and signaling agents. And when all of that's coming, it's like scrambled eggs in there, right? And then the communication out, holy schmoly, the filters that we have to go through to actually get that out because of the toxic burden of things that didn't exist a generation or two ago.
Well, and to add to that idea, to build on what you're sharing, often when a cancer diagnosis comes along, or even the fear of a cancer diagnosis or heading in that direction, people go into overdrive, research overdrive, and they're absorbing even more information that they don't fully understand. And there's scary numbers. And then there's these quacks over here that do it naturally. And should I believe them? And then there's just this. So we're already putting all of this information in. And then it goes to a whole nother level for people that get cancer or have diagnoses, which leads me to ask the question, do you think part of that nervous system or emotional reaction it has been conditioned into us by the media, I would say, and doctors about the word cancer.
Oh.
Do you think that needs to be destigmatized? Because currently people hear that word and it's like a white flag to life. It's like, I'm done. Apparently I'm done. Right? Yeah.
Such a good question. So context, when I was diagnosed in 1991, there were no cell phones. There was no internet. There was no Dr. Google. There were maybe a handful of alternative healthcare books on a bookshelf somewhere that I had to go knowingly seek out, right? The after being told there was nothing I could do and I was sent home to die, I went to my local library and found a book on the shelf of some total unknown guy I'd never heard of by the name of Deepak Chopra and a book called Quantum Healing in 1991. Which completely changed my perspective in an instant. I had my own paradigm shift, my own quantum healing in that moment to see my life through a different filter, through a different lens than the one that I previously had. I also, in that time for myself, because of the trauma environment that I came from, something intuitive inside of me said, leave the environment that made you sick. Get as far away from it as possible. I could do that in 1991. I could block my phone number, be unlisted. I could live in a faraway state. No one could find me. No one needed to know what was going on with me. I didn't have to speak to anybody. I also, of my age, being 19 in 1991, I was ashamed of that diagnosis and all that led up to that diagnosis. I didn't want my peers. I was finally free. I was finally a full state away from the trauma in which all this started, in a place where I was starting a new life and identity, and I did not want to be known as the cancer girl. Plus, I was only given a few months to live, so I did not want to leave this world with everyone remembering that part about me.
Yeah.
So as weird as that sounds, those were the best gifts I could have ever been given. The lack of input, of well-meaning advice, of influencers, of this person from this environment saying, oh, my uncle did this treatment and he's still alive to tell the story, and all this information coming at me. I am likely here today because I had way less input than if I'd been diagnosed today. So I'm wanting people to hear this, because the paralysis by analysis is real. The overwhelm is real. The well-meaning advisors and influencers out there, I think, are coming from the right place, but it is not helpful. So instead, you need to be incredibly diligent about what information you're allowing in and about what information you're going to share. But today, everyone wants to get on a social media place and tell their story, which is good. I did not tell my story until 2012.
Interesting.
I know. That always flips people out.
Yeah. And why is that?
So many reasons. We could go into a whole podcast on that at some point. But a lot of things I was learning about myself, where I came from, where I was, what I didn't want to be associated with. I'd come from a lot of victimization. I did not want to be a victim. I did not want to be a cancer patient. I wanted to be, it overflung it for me. I became a survivor, which I do not associate with that concept anymore. But I also never believed I was going to survive this, and I wasn't going to fight it. I never had the fight mentality or the F cancer mentality. That was never there. In fact, there was a little bit of relief around the diagnosis, because I had come from such a dark place that I kind of looked at it as kind of a sexy exit strategy. Kind of a martyred, noble exit strategy, right? And so suddenly I'm kind of like, I'm still here. Now what? I was kind of like, oh, geez, what do I do with this information? So then I was never going to work with cancer. So I went down a very different path of where I was going to go with my career. And of course, that's a whole nother story. The universe had other plans for me. But it was, I wanted that as far away from me as possible. But I started studying, thanks to that quantum healing book, thanks to my process of what I was going through. I did have enough understanding that trauma played a big role into my cancer process. Later, I learned all the other things that were playing a role into it in the Terrain 10 process, but I learned for myself that was, for me, my priority. And so having the accidental read of that book and then switching my major from chemistry, biology, pre-med to psychology, biology, psychoneuroimmunology, I did a self-constructed major in 1991. I started stumbling across the work of Robert Ader, of Candace Pert, of Bruce Lipton. Bruce Lipton, long before his book came out in 2011, you guys. 2011, yeah. 20 years later, his book comes out and the world knows about him. But I'd been following his research and his work for 20 years before that book
hit mainstream. We're lucky to have had him on this show before, which is cool.
Oh, he's precious. Like, he's just so, and what he was seeing and studying in the lab, and they still call this guy woo-woo.
I know.
I'm like, anyway, so it's like all those things. I was lucky. And then to later, now coming through all the filter, people like our colleague, Rachel, oh my gosh, how did I just do this? Kelly Turner. I was like, where did Rachel come from? I'm like, where that just landed in my amidst there. But Kelly Turner, when she wrote her book, Radical Remission, I was so excited when that came out, because it was speaking to what I had experienced for myself and so many other patients along the journey, which was, we all keep looking outside of ourselves for the answer. We all keep looking outside of ourselves for the tangible thing that's going to fix it, whether it's chemo or surgery or radiation, whether it's off-label drugs, whether it's a particular diet, a supplement, an herb, a spiritual practice, a seance, whatever it is that they think it's going to be that's going to fix them, is something perceived on the outside to fix the inside. Mm. And yet what Kelly's research showed and continues to show is that there's three tangible things. Now it's 10 factors, not just 9 factors, but those tangibles are exercise, which is her 10th factor she added, supplements, not even specific to which ones. It's almost like the placebo effect is probably just as impactful. And diet also, her research did not show a particular one, but the other 7 are the inside job. The other 7 are that piece where we started our very conversation at the front of the hour, of the importance of we're looking outside to fix this, and it's an inside job. And why the guy laughed at you when you said, well, okay, if 90-95% is diet and lifestyle, why aren't we doing something about that? We weren't teaching resourcing. We weren't teaching accountability, personal responsibility. We weren't making people aware. We weren't making people empowered. Because an educated and empowered patient is a very difficult to kill patient.
Right? Absolutely.
And killing cancer and cancer cells is actually not that difficult. Mm-hmm. But keeping them down while building yourself up is difficult, because that depends on the person. And so what happens every time I have these conversations, I will invariably, inevitably get hate mail of people telling me that I'm blaming them for their cancer. I'm going to repeat this here. You do not know what you do not know until, and once you know better, you do better. So there is no blame, but now that you have this information, you cannot go back to where you came from. So when we start to educate and empower people to understand that the water they drink matters, the air they breathe matters, the food choices they make matters, the timing of their food choices and eating schedules matter, the body care products matter. So when everyone's like, well, it's just a little bit of glyphosate on this, or a little bit of parabens in this, or a little bit of pesticide and on this, or a little bit of blue light exposure, those little bits didn't exist a generation or two ago. And now we're little bitting the crap out of ourselves. Now it's a cumulative effect, and our mitochondrial bucket is overflowing. We have to think about things differently than our ancestors did. That simple.
Yeah. So I'm curious then, and maybe there's no short list whatsoever for people that are resonating with this idea of like, okay, less information. Yep. I feel bombarded. I'm overwhelmed. My nervous system's jacked up. What are the 1 or 2 or 3 books that people they should follow? Like, because inevitably, like you said, until you know, you don't know. And so, like, what is the short list of resources that people should focus on?
I love that. Well, almost everyone has said to me when I was in private practice, and then years later when I was consulting other big practices and then training others. So I've probably had my hand directly on, I don't know, 20,000 patients, my indirect hand on hundreds of thousands of patients at this time. Almost everyone says, but I was healthy until I got cancer. So that one always blows my mind. It's like, how disembodied are we?
Yeah.
How truly clueless are we? It makes me sad, because this information should be intuitive, but it should also be taught at the very earliest of teachings. We should be teaching preconception care. You and I talked a little bit about that before this conversation. We should be teaching how to care for during your pregnancy and lactation years, and your food introduction schedules, and your ways that you're choosing to or not to vaccinate, or the timing of that, and when absolutely not to vaccinate, and when to, like, if someone's got a sniffle, don't go get them their vaccines that day. Like, things like that of, how do we start from the beginning to help people get the best chance they can get? Like, I'm coming back in my next lifetime as your next child, because I want to have a good running start, because you've learned a lot of things and you applied it. But the majority of folks don't know this information. So when we think about a few simple resources, and this is not a plug for my book, it's that I took 30 years asking this question that you're asking, right? Applying it to myself, applying it to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of patients later, which is basically a manual of understanding everything that we're putting in, on, and around us, which is the book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. Mm-hmm. So at the very beginning offers a really rudimentary questionnaire so you can start to create some awareness where you might have blind spots. We'll put a link in the show notes that has a more deep dive questionnaire, a lot more modernized, a lot more nuanced, even scale, like weighted, even know percentage wise, what is my priority? And then you can go and read that priority or two in the chapter in the book. If you want to read the book from front to back, go for it. But it's a lot of information. So I tell people, take the questionnaire, the one in the book, take the questionnaire that we'll give you online that's a little more in depth, and then see what maybe your top two or three blind spots are, and then go and read those chapters. So then you can start sort of the little micro changes in your life that are tangible and doable. And when you succeed at that, then you can start adding more information. So less is more, really. That's one place. The second place is I'd really strongly encourage people to read The Biology of Belief.
Yeah, that's on my short list for everyone too.
It's so integral because it brings in all these famous researchers, all the work that led up. Like I said, I started reading about him in 1991. His book did not come out for 20 years. He was doing research for a very long time before that. And people like Candace Pert was his friend, and Robert Ader, and all the others in this field. This research had been going on since the 50s, right? So there is really good data and it's ongoing. So that would be the next one. I really like the book Radical Remission, mm-hmm. Kelly Turner and Radical Hope, because it talks about those intangibles that are critical to be aware of and to change. So basically, three questions that I always ask patients is really simple. This will tell me everything I need to know about how this patient's going to do. I ask them, what brings you joy? I ask them, for what are you grateful? And I ask them, what did you come here to do? What is your purpose? Because what happens the moment we get a diagnosis of cancer, we become that diagnosis. We become that cancer. Everyone's like, I'm a breast cancer man, triple negative. I've got this. I've got that pancreatic. I would go and host these cancer retreats. And every single night, the first night, we'd go around and we'd ask everyone to tell us three things about themselves that had nothing to do with cancer. Maddie, it was like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
The first person, they might go, oh, I have a collection of unicorns or something, like something. And then suddenly like, and my breast cancer, blah, blah, blah. And they just go down this place. And like, that to me was the reflection that they became the cancer. They could not see themselves as a being that was dealing with a cancerous process.
Yeah.
They didn't then have the ability to ask, why are my cells behaving this way now? They didn't understand that cancer was a messenger, a signaling agent to have them explore the environment in which they got sick.
Yeah.
And to start to be empowered to do something about it. That's where people need to start, is to realize, as you said, cancer is not an enemy. We wage war on. It is not something we want to hate or despise. It's not fun, right? But it is a signaling agent. It is telling you something. It is a messenger, and it's an opportunity to look through a different lens and change your environment and your circumstances in a meaningful way. And when someone is met with that diagnosis, a few things happen. Just like we meet any big stressor, we freeze, fly, or go into fear, right? So like that whole moment, the way we even meet that diagnosis is prognostic. So if we can't find joy, if we can't have gratitude, and if we don't know purpose, that is poor prognosis. And if we stay in the place of fear and paralysis by analysis, that keeps our nervous system in a place that we literally cannot heal. It's impossible. Your immune system cannot work in that high stress of state of stress and duress. You don't digest. You don't rest. You don't repair. You don't regenerate when you're in fear. And the anecdote of fear is trust, faith, love, right? Those are the places that are outside, that are not outside jobs. Those are inside jobs. We've spent, a lot of us have a lot of angst around that because we've looked outside of us for love, for faith, for trust. But you can't have that if you don't have it inside first.
Oh, I love everything you're saying. And it reminds me of a conversation, which I don't mean to start another rabbit hole, but about this idea of sort of pop spirituality that's popped up in the last couple of decades. And again, it's this idea of, outsourcing my self-responsibility and engaging with a field, an aura, an idea, a concept of which is not me and will make me superior by dragging me up to its level. But at its core, like you said, faith and those ideas are the internal environment.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many cool studies out there that show that even if you go camping for 2 weeks, completely off the grid, leave your phone at home, you go and camp, your circadian rhythm resets, your microbiome resets, your immune system resets, your sleep resets, like everything resets, your digestion, everything.
Yeah.
It's like to think about all those years that we just sat around the fire or squatted in the, in the bushes, all these different things that we were being exposed to so many different organisms to create the diversity within this tube that our bodies wrapped around that created more resilience for us to be able to meet whatever came our way. Right. So these are things now today we all are 74 degrees Fahrenheit all the dang time.
Yeah.
Like, gotta be comfortable. Can't be hungry. Can't be sad. Can't be tired. Can't be bloated, whatever. So there's a pill for that. 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 There's a dial on a thermostat for that. We are in this place where the loss of that sort of like hormesis of just a little stress can actually increase your vitality. So take that initial diagnosis or that initial fear or whatever, and use it as a hormetic tool to say, okay, that was uncomfortable. What am I going to do about it? Great. Mm. This is information. Where am I going to gather more information? What steps am I going to make to change my circumstance, to change my environment? What is the invitation here? What is the opportunity? What is the message? Those are the things that put us into movement, emotion, that instead of getting locked down of, oh, woe is me, or I'm a victim, or F the cancer, or I'm going into battle, I need everyone to come along. It's like, wow, we don't need more battle.
Mm.
We don't need more doing. We need more being. We need more clarity. We need more stillness. We need to know what's going on inside of us. Because whenever there's an organization we work with, I'd love for you to get to know Raj Jhana if you don't know him. And
no,
Liberate, LIBERATE. We were their beta. Our cancer community was their beta testers, which my whole mantra is test, assess, address, don't guess. So the way I help people move through all that massive amount of information is to check, test themselves. We talked about certain blood tests, certain imaging, gathering information before you start to apply tools, whether it's from standard of care, alternative care, or a combination of the two, right? Don't guess. Don't jump into protocols until you gather more information. And so what Raj does in the mental emotional place with Liberate is the same thing, kind of a test and assess of the mental emotional. They trauma map. They understand, they get a sense of how that patient is wired mentally and emotionally. And then they find the tools that are best matched to those particular patterns. So instead of like, I'm going to go here and go do ayahuasca in the jungle, and over here I'm going to go do touch for therapy, and over here I'm going to do Reiki, and over here I'm going to go prayer, over here I'm going to do meditation. That is just as much bullshit in. You know what I mean? That's also like, everyone's like, but I'm doing all these spiritual and energetic things. Doing is the key, right? That's like, that's exactly the problem. You're throwing all this stuff at it. Are you integrating it? Are you making sense of it? Are you listening to the messages that are being elucidated from it? Nope. They're just on to the next grand adventure of checking out and looking outside of themselves for the information.
Yeah.
And so I love working with Liberate because they help us understand patterns on that mental emotional spectrum. And one of the findings we've had in the research, and we're getting ready to publish some of this, is 70% of all the patients, cancer patients, I think we had over, I can't remember how many hundreds or thousands at this point, went through the program. The 70% of those folks, honestly, their biggest need, their biggest trigger is to be seen and heard. Is there a pill for that?
Is yeah, there it's a treatment? It's is there in a human form.
And so when we're so busy being overly connected, too much input, there is no space to be seen and heard. And if you can't get it out in a 15-minute soundbite that's kind of entertaining to capture some, no one's going to listen.
Yeah. And it's pseudo-connection, right? It's not real.
It is totally pseudo-connection. And pseudo-connection is far more toxic.
Yeah.
It actually takes you away from source. So it's just an interesting thing. And I think, again, people always want me to come onto these conversations and say, what's the one thing? I mean, you know, you're going to ask me this question moment, so I'll pause it for now. But I do have some thoughts on advice of like, what would I take out of this conversation? Of kind of the one thing. But, you know, it's like, I want people to understand, again, thinking about our mitochondria as receiver, translator, signaling agents, thinking about the world around us and how it's changed in the past 11,250 years, for instance, mm-hmm. what inputs have come back in, the nature of the polarity of the world around us in this tug of war and the massive amount of input of things that didn't exist a generation or two ago. It's like, but of course we have cancer. Of course we do. Like, how amazing is that? Because of course it's trying to heal us.
Yeah, well, and trying to heal us, and for all of the convenience and shortcuts we've created as a society, like, there's a fallout. There's a price to pay for trying to move forward faster than we should in any aspect.
Yeah. I don't even know if this is where you wanted to go today, my friend, but here we are.
This is fantastic. I love it. I always pretty much exclusively have a list of questions that I've thought really deeply about, and then I never ask any of them. But you said you weren't intending to plug your book. I will 100% plug your book. It's incredible. I've read it a bunch of times. And so where can anybody that's listening, that's sort of vibing and loving this conversation, where can they get more of you? Where can they get your book? Where can they find you on the internet?
Okay. Well, like you said earlier, I'm kind of everywhere right now. So medical stages and conferences all over the world, which I love. It's really fun for me to engage. It's my dopamine rush to be able to connect with others in that way. But drnasha.com, drnasha.com has a lot of my speaking engagements, events. It has links to my book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, links to my book, Mistletoe and the Future of Integrative, Emerging Future of Integrative Oncology. It also has a big, huge download of lots of other conversations, including the two previous ones I've had with Maddie and other amazing interviewers over the years. It's kind of a collection of just free access of information. I also started my own podcast of people that make me like ask questions and think about the world differently, Metabolic Matters. So you can follow me there. I think it's in all the usual places. You mentioned our nonprofit, the Metabolic Terrain Institute of Health, MTIH.org. is where we're doing our research, building out our research lab. We'll be part of funding our hospital, Integrative Oncology Hospital and Research Institute, as well as create grants for patients' access to this type of care because it's not covered by the antiquated insurance models. And then my sort of other side of the spectrum are, I spent years looking for certain supplements that really took care of my community, very specific needs that I had. I'm very picky about fillers and types of things in supplements. I'm really picky about certain nutrients and things that are actually very contraindicated in a cancering patient. So instead of waiting for somebody else to create it, we did ourselves. It's called MitoVita. So it's not been available to the public. It's only been available in our network and to our clinicians, but we're getting ready to change that. So MitoVita.com is where you could find some of those very, very specific curated combinations. And then our data platform, when people say there's no data, there's no research on all the crap she's talking about, there actually is, just no one's done a meaningful way of gathering it. It's almost like our data platform would be like a mitochondria. It's taking in millions of metrics, millions of data points, lots of information, lots of input. It's translating that. It's elucidating the patterns. And then it's helping create a clinical decision-making tree for clinicians that need time to be present with their patient and not thinking about what treatment am I going to do? Because the lost art of medicine is the connection with the patient and how much we have to do to assess all that data and translate that data and come up with a treatment plan around that data. This is where AI can be of help, right? When we're asking the right questions, we're taking in the right information, we're translating it, and we're making very evidence-informed and evidence-based choices based on that data. That means the doctor gets to free up their time to be with the patient. So that patient's most important healing tool of being seen and heard is met. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Lots of places. I don't know how you fit life into 24 hours each day. It's wild.
But I put all my tools, right? Right. Yeah.
But yeah, links in the show notes below. So scroll down, click the link, jump into Nasha's world. It's obviously fantastic and amazing and an endless world to learn in. And I love learning from you and just seeing all the great things that you're doing. But as you alluded to before, final question. What is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
I really wish people would start within versus immediately rushing outside. So there's a handout we can also give in the show notes, kind of like the first, like the six steps to do if you've been diagnosed. Number one is be still, right? Just be still, breathe, go inward, really tune in to what's going on. Now, obviously there are times and places where there are medical emergencies that have to be dealt with, but rarely is cancer a medical emergency. The diagnosis creates an emergency on the way you react to that diagnosis. That's why I invite you to get still and choose to respond versus react, to gather information internally while you also start to gather information externally to determine the course of action that you're going to take. And so those are, I can't even tell you how different outcomes are for patients who do that versus jump right into reactivity. The prognosis, the progression-free and overall survival rates are far better in these patients who took a moment before jumping in.
I think that's great advice in all aspects of life, actually.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I'm glad you came back and we've got to do it again. I say that every time, but yeah, I love having you here. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Maddie. All the best to you and your sweet family.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember, too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.